All right, hey everyone, we're here with Ian Shepherd of Production Advice. Ian actually mastered the Long Wait album that is coming out on Tuesday, the 25th of September, 2016, for those who are listening to this in the distant future. he managed to do an incredible job of my mixes, taking all of these sort of mixes that have been done over a long period of time, done very differently, and made them sound all like a nice coherent album and not just a combination of songs. So thank you for that, and thanks for coming on, Ian.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start by maybe if you want to walk me through just sort of your process of mastering the Long Wait album. Like, what were your challenges? What was fun about it? Did you do anything different? That sort of thing.
Sure. It was pretty straightforward. It was kind of enjoyable because, you know, it was no major headaches. And I didn't have to, you know, sometimes you kind of feel like you're reinventing the wheel with stuff. But you know, no, I mean, it was, you know, I usually start at song one. I mean, the nice thing these days is you can pull stuff up into a DAW, so you can see all the waveforms. Mm-hmm. And although anybody who knows anything about me will know that I will tell you, you can't tell very much from looking at waveforms. you can kind of see, like, I could instantly see that track four had been more heavily controlled in terms of the dynamics than some of the others. The waveform is more squared off. And I can see that, for example, there's a lot of contrast in the final song on the album. So when I load up an album these days, I usually give the waveforms a quick glance because, for example, if the first song is really quiet, then it might not be the best song for me to start with when I'm mastering because kind of one thing I like to do is go for the loudest moments, figure out where they're going to be, how they're going to sound, and then that's kind of a reference point for me, if you like, for everything else. Because, you know, for me, mastering is about finding the kind of the center of gravity of a collection of songs or a kind of a line that kind of runs through so that, you know, I don't want everything to sound the same, but I want it all to flow and to sound consistent. But quite often people will start the album with one of the bigger songs. And if that's the case, if I don't kind of immediately see, oh, well, hey, track five is really loud and nothing else is, then I'll usually start with song one. And it's usually takes me about an hour to an hour and a half to get the sound right on the first song. It's quite a long process because you're kind of, you're figuring out what the sound should be. You know, for me, mastering is this kind of interesting balance of being arrogant in the sense that I'm kind of coming in and going, well, Björkman's been working on this for years, but I'm going to make it sound like this. But also being humble because I have to have empathy for what you were trying to achieve in the songs and recordings and the mixes, you know, kind of understand what your final goal is and try and get the music closer to that. You know, that's what's going to make you happy, is that if I can make it sound more like the thing that you wanted it to sound like all along. So it's kind of an exploring process with the first, you know, you have immediate instincts like, okay, I'm going to, you know, for me, the mastering process is always lift up the level, listen to the song, apply some EQ, listen to the song again, think about the dynamics, bring in maybe some compression if necessary, and then listen again. And at that point, you've probably done stuff that makes it feel like the level has changed. So you think about the level again, and then it kind of goes around in circles and you kind of hone in on this perfect setting for the song initially. And so that can take a while for the first song, but after that it tends to flow more quickly because you've kind of had that, you've got that reference point. And I mean, you know, it's not, I don't always just concentrate on the first song. Sometimes it's better not to spend too long on the first one and to move on and then revisit it, because it's pretty common for me to get about halfway through the album and realize actually what I came up with for song one isn't quite right, you know, and needs some tweaking in the context of the other songs. Because that for me is where mastering works best, is where everything is part of, you know, when you're mastering a collection of songs and everything kind of fits into a whole, whether it's like an EP or an album or a compilation or a playlist or whatever it might be. And so then I just step through each song, you know, kind of, and take it as it comes, really. I know that there are engineers who will sit and listen to an entire album from beginning to end before they start work. I don't have the patience for that. But I mean, by the time I've finished, I've listened to the whole thing several times, you know, in terms of the total amount of time you spend playing it. But I probably focus on certain bits more than others. Mm-hmm. I like to keep mastering simple. I like it when it's just basically EQ compression and a little bit of limiting, which was the case for your album for the most part. I have a question for you before you tell me anything. I don't know very. I mean, you just sent. You know, I knew what the project was. I'd known for ages that you had the band and you wanted to release these songs, and it got to the point where you're kind of like, okay, this I have to release this now. I'm just going to send it to you.
I'm done. I've decided that it's done.
What is it there? You know, art is never finished. It's only abandoned.
Exactly.
So it got to the bit where you decided enough's enough already. I don't think from memory that you gave me any majorly detailed notes particularly. So I just kind of, which is quite normal. So, some people send me reams of information, which actually quite often I don't read. I mean, I do read it, but I tend to read it afterwards. I like to come to something completely clean and just do whatever my instinct tells me. Mm-hmm. And then if somebody sent me loads of notes, then I read them and kind of compare notes with myself, if you like, and maybe make adjustments to what I've done based on what they've said. Yeah. But what's nice is usually my feelings and what they're saying line up. You know, which is the ideal, really, because if you're completely on a different plane from your clients, then it's not going to work out.
Absolutely.
But I said, so what I was going to ask you about yours, I'm guessing you recorded 4 or 5 or 6 of these in the same space. Mm-hmm. Or definitely mixed them in the same space, and then the others were in a variety of locations or mixed in a variety of places, because I see a common thread between some of the songs and then others are completely different, which interested me.
Do you know which ones?
I don't know which ones. I could have a quick look and tell you. Okay, so song one.
Yep.
Song three. Maybe I think song four is probably different. I'm guessing this is a complete guess. I could have an egg on my face for this. Song four and five, I reckon, might have something in common in terms of the way they were done. Song six looks completely different to me, but song seven is similar to it.
Yep.
And I would guess song eight is in the same area. Then song nine is more like the first, so it's splitting into two groups, isn't it? As far as I'm concerned, the first three, and then the final song. I don't know what's going on with the final song. Okay, I'm going to guess there were three different mix scenarios or three different recording scenarios involved.
There definitely were. So I recorded this in the home studio. All of the drums and bass were recorded in the home studio.
Mm-hmm.
And just basically behind me where I'm sitting right now. And then the acoustic guitar was recorded at a commercial studio downtown. And then some of the electric guitars were recorded there most of the electric guitars were recorded there, and then the vocals were recorded there, and then it was all mixed here. But I think a lot of it has to do with some of those songs have session players that either just sent me their files mm-hmm. or brought in something different that makes it sound like it was done in a variety of places, but. It's interesting to see that breakdown for sure.
Do the ones that I highlighted as being different kind of tie up with that in any way? Because what I'm basing that on is the kind of EQ that I applied.
Oh, really? Okay.
So because several of the songs I took stuff out at 100 hertz.
Okay.
That's a kind of a trend that runs through. And then a couple of them, it was a bit higher up. And then some of them, the ones that I mentioned, whatever they were, 5, 6... And 5, 6, 7, 8, I think.
Uh-huh.
No, 5 is another one where I took quite a lot. They had a build-up around that kind of area, that low-mid or the, I guess that's a bass region that needed sorting out. Whereas the 6, 7, and 8, definitely, I use much less EQ on those. In fact, song 8, I use no EQ at all. Whereas song 10, I think it was, has quite a bizarre looking EQ.
Yeah, and that's the orchestra song too. That has like that was recorded. That's a real strings recorded it in a big room downtown here with eight high schoolers actually playing strings, and it was recorded double tracked. So it's also so it's kind of a 16-piece orchestra, but it's really twice an 8-piece.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, the trick is I don't remember. It's been a while since I mastered this, and I can't remember which songs are which, so I don't remember enough about the arrangements to kind of give you detailed feedback. I guess we could pause for a minute, and I could do that. That might be fun. But
So the one you said, number 8, that you didn't apply EQ, it's very interesting because that's the one that has the trumpets in the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because... The drums sound slightly different in certain songs because I do use samples on some of them. Mm-hmm. And especially in 8, I have a very particular snare sound in the verses of that song. And that's like that's a definite sample. And it just makes it sound completely different than just more of a taste decision than anything else. But it's funny that you didn't use any EQ because there's just piles and piles of instrumentation on that song. There's like a 3 triple tracked guitar. There's all these horns and all of this, all of these vocals. And I use that. That's one of the songs I used a lot of parallel compression on the vocals. So it's funny that is not the one that has a lot of buildup.
Yeah. It's so the ones with more buildup were 1, 3, 4. I mean, it's interesting that you've kind of blown my theory out of the water slightly, because the fact you recorded the drums and the bass all in one place. Usually, the kind of adjustments that I'm making, for people listening, you've got to imagine fairly narrow. They're not notches, but they're definite dips in the frequency response. And I mean, they're kind of they're not huge. I mean, they're kind of 3-4 dBs, and it's a very common thing for me to do. Like, if just looking at the EQ curve of the first song, that's a kind of classic shape that I apply over and over again, where I've got there's a low cut to take out some really deep kind of rumbly stuff that wasn't really achieving very much. Then there's a boost at it's quite low down, it's kind of 35 hertz. There probably isn't anything going on down at 35 hertz, but the upper end of that will start to boost the bottom end of the bass. Then there's this dip at, on this one, it's at 80 hertz. And then there's another dip at 150, which, okay, so that's nearly twice. That's a harmonic, right, of the first one.
Right.
Twice the frequency, more or less. And then it's kind of a gentle lift, and it's kind of smooth with a bit of a dip just to reduce a bit of harshness in the high mids. But that kind of shape of a deep boost followed by a cut somewhere higher up, what you often get, I mean, even coming from recording studios, it's nothing to do with home recording or anything else, is there will be a build-up somewhere in the low mid, the low bass, and not quite enough deep down below. And the nice thing about mastering is that, I like to use multiband compression when I'm mastering. And the nice thing about that is that I can control that deep bass. So I can actually push in extra energy, but then have it controlled by a compressor and not have to worry. Whereas in the mix, you might well not have a multiband anywhere in sight. You probably don't have it. So if you boosted that when you were mixing, the low end would probably start to sound out of control. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So doing it in the mastering stage. So, yeah, that's quite a common thing for me to do, and that's the kind of trend. But the fact that there are different frequencies, I mean, that might just be to do with the different key that the songs are in. Obviously, if you're not playing a particular... Like, let's imagine, I don't remember, but let's imagine it was the low note in the bass that was booming out that I wanted to clean up. Obviously, if you don't play a particular note, it's not going to boom in the room or in the mixing environment or anywhere else.
Exactly.
It's probably not to do with your monitoring environment, because usually what you find is that if if somebody is making EQ choices because of the room or the speakers they're listening on, it will tend to be very consistent. And that was what is interesting. That's why I brought it up about this album, is because they're all different.
Right.
You know, it's something else going on rather than just correcting for the listening environment that you're working in. So my theory could still be right, but I guess the jury's out.
Well, I think also a lot of those songs are the ones that are more sort of acoustic guitar heavy.
Mm-hmm.
It could have something to do with that for sure.
Yeah, well, an acoustic guitar is a kind of classic instrument where you might get a buildup, because especially depending on the mic placement, you know, if you find just the right place, you can get quite a balanced frequency response. But quite often with an acoustic, you'll get something kind of hooting out at you. It's not necessarily that it's a huge problem, but it's the kind of thing that it's nice to fine tune when you're mastering, because you can just overall get kind of, well, so, I mean, for example, you know, if you've got one song, like this first song was booming at 80 hertz, whereas the third song, it was 100.
Right.
If I hadn't put those EQs in, you would have heard two different kind of boomy frequencies on those songs. And the problem with that is that it prevents you lifting the bass up otherwise. You know, one of the goals of mastering is to get a nice even frequency response, assuming you've got a fairly full arrangement so that all the different frequency bands are represented. You want that to be even. If it's kind of, if it's uneven, then, you know, if there's too much upper mids, it's going to sound harsh. If there's too much low bass, it'll sound kind of boomy and thuddy and out of control.
Right.
So doing each of those individual tweaks on each of the songs without really radically changing the sound of them brings them closer to each other so that you can balance them, which, you know, is kind of the goal. So, acoustic guitar could well be a candidate.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about what you did was there are some of the songs, and this is basically comes back to what you're talking about. So there's in track 7, it's called "Where Do They Go," and it's in the mix. It was always fairly mid rangey, and I could never figure out how to make it not like kind of narrowy sounding, very a lot of like mids. And not too bright, or it seemed like it was a narrow frequency response of that whole song, and I just couldn't figure out how to clean it up. But you did a great job doing it. So, which was one of the reasons why it's always nice to have a mastering engineer master your mixes, because it gives you a different set of ears to actually have an unbiased perspective on what it should sound like you were saying in the beginning, taking my thing and but making it basically sound as good as it possibly can.
Absolutely. It's we all have it, don't you? You work on something for long enough, you can't see the wood for the trees, or you can't hear the wood for the trees, or whatever the appropriate
whatever the saying is.
I remember I mastered some stuff for Graham at the Recording Revolution. Actually it was for Dueling Mixes, the thing he does with Joe Gilder, and they both mixed the same song. They had two different mixes and I mastered both mixes. And it was an interesting process, because exactly what we're talking about happened. They both ended up closer to each other. They sat next to each other better. They still didn't sound the same, but they just balanced better. But kind of within seconds of putting Graham's on, I said, oh, there's a really boomy frequency. And I think it was the kick drum. I think the kick drum had this kind of sort of quite a ringing sort of tone to it. And I just went straight in with a notch and took it out. And he said afterwards that he was kind of quite shocked by that, by the speed with which I'd gone, no, not having that. And it was gone. And he was like, I quite liked that quality about it, all the rest of it. And I was like, yeah, but if you leave that in, anybody who's got a speaker that happens to sing out a bit at that frequency, it's just going to sound ridiculous. You know, I took out enough that the flavor was still there without it kind of going over the top. And again, that's one of the goals, is this thing called translation, where you want to make it sound as good as it can on the widest possible range of systems that you can. You know, so if somebody plays it in a car with a massive bass bin in the back, it's going to sound the way they expect. And if somebody plays it on their phone, it's going to sound the way they expect, kind of tinny and horrible, and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's interesting, though, that you mentioned, I was looking at the EQ for that song and thinking, oh, I didn't do that much to it. But then I realized I can tell you guys a ninja move.
Okay.
That or a Jedi move. You know, you always call me the Jedi Master, don't you? So it should be a Jedi move.
Yeah, I do.
Which is to use, it's a kind of new secret weapon. I've only been using it quite recently. The great thing is it's free. Okay. It's an EQ called TDR Nova.
Okay.
It's actually a dynamic EQ, which means that you can have it boosting only when certain things are happening or not happening. But I'm not using it in that way. The other thing that's different about it is it's a parallel EQ. So it basically splits the signal into two parallel paths. Huh. And then, so for example, if you push in something that looks like a parametric EQ, just like a gentle bell curve going up, what that actually is something that's been high and low pass filtered in the parallel band, and you're just adding more of that in. So it creates a parametric EQ. Now, I don't quite understand why that ends up sounding different, except that I think there's something else going on. Somebody said to me that maybe they use a little bit of saturation or something. Anyway, the reason I like it so much, the bottom line is I find I can boost the highs more without kind of one of the classic problems with a digital EQ boosting the high frequencies is that everything that was kind of spiky and that jumped out at you in the original obviously gets boosted and it feels spikier and jumps out at you more. It doesn't really. It's just it's the way our ears work, and that's how it feels.
Right.
But it is, you know, you listen to something, you think, oh, I want some more top end in that, and you go in with your EQ, and it suddenly starts sounding brittle and hard and unpleasant. Mm-hmm. I get less of that with this EQ. You can reduce that effect by kind of driving things into a compressor anyway, which I'm doing as well. But right. Yeah, the Nova is really nice because it seems to kind of bring out some of that openness and that clarity in the top end without making. So I think that's rather than there aren't any huge cuts in the mid range on that song. Mm-hmm. There's a boost down at 60 hertz just to bring out some thump in the kick drum probably.
Okay.
And then the majority of the rest of the work is happening because I have that high frequency boost. It's still not huge. It's still only about 3 dB and it's kind of up, but it's quite high. It's sort of 12K. So it's right in that kind of air band that people like to talk about. But yeah, not making it kind of spiky and stuff. And then the other thing would be the multiband compression will control some of those mid-range issues without affecting the highs or the lows and vice versa.
Right. Yeah, I can see like the combination of taming the maybe lows and low mids with compression and then adding some air kind of opening up the song.
Exactly.
Because that's what I thought was missing from the song. It's like it's not like open enough, you know, and there's plenty of space. There's plenty of reverb and stuff on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like a frequency openness that I was looking for and I could never find.
It still amazes me how much difference tiny little moves can make. There was nothing like it, I don't think, on your album, but something I've just done recently where I was listening to it and I'd been working on it for a bit and I was thinking, well, it's I'm pretty happy with it, but I just wish they added some more beef to that snare, you know, a bit more kind of low mid in the snare to make it punch out a bit more. And I didn't believe it was going to work, but I just thought, well, I'll just try going in with a tiny little. So it was really quite a narrow notch. And I kind of hunted around and found the frequency where I wanted the snare to. And I only added maybe 1 or 2 dB. And it made all the difference. It made the world of difference. You know, it seemed to lift the snare out of the mix and have the result. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of listening to it and A-B-ing it, knocking, thinking, I can't believe that works. You know, even after all this time, I should know by now that sometimes these things work. But it's, you know, if you'd said to me, oh, 1 or 2 dB, I'd be like, really? but it genuinely did make a huge difference. So still surprises me.
Yeah, one of the things that is always worth to remember just for everybody listening is like when you're doing either whether that's master bus EQing or actually mastering EQ is that doing the, you know, turning it off and on just to hear the difference like every like fairly frequently will tell you a lot about what you're doing because you can't imagine how much the like 1 dB over here, 1 dB over here, and 2 dB up there, or whatever. That will change it very drastically, even though you might think not.
Absolutely, especially if you're using boosts. I forget what there's a mathematical reason for it, but basically boosting a particular frequency has more apparent effect on the overall sound than cutting at a different frequency. I tend not to worry about this stuff too much. I kind of cut what I don't like and boost what I do. But of course, the other thing is, I think I can't let that comment go by without warning people that they need to level match. You knew this was coming, right? Because the EQ appears to change the level of the music, I mean, for me, toggling that 1 or 2 dB, I think that's a valid test, right? Because all I was changing was that one tiny little place. But if I was bypassing an entire EQ, one of those more complicated shapes for a whole song, I would always, well, actually, I would use the plugin that I developed called Perception that some people may know about to do this for me. But anybody can do it. I would measure the loudness of the song without the EQ and then measure the loudness of the song with the EQ or the compression or whatever processing I was putting on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that would then tell me that, oh, maybe, you know, after all the processing, it's a dB louder. So then what I would do is turn down the after signal by a dB so that I can bypass that EQ or all the processing and hear it without that level change. Because the risk is often you can get fooled just by the level change into thinking that something sounds better when actually it doesn't. Yeah, it's I've told you many times.
We've had this conversation before.
Absolutely. And if anybody's listening, I won't go on about it too long because I'm sure some people listening will have heard me say it before as well. But, it's called the Fletcher-Munson curve or the equal loudness curve. It's something that happens in our brains. Anything that's a bit louder will sound bassier and treblier, basically. They also call it the smile curve because as you push it up, you know, kind of the EQ shape gets more and more like a raised at either edge, like a smile. Kind of bypassing things in and out is a great way to kind of get a reality check. And when you do that, when you loudness match and then bypass, you know, I could be working for maybe 15, 20 minutes on a song and I think it's all going great. I've got everything the way that I think it should be. It's sounding fantastic. Then I do the loudness matching bypass and suddenly realize, it's moved too far away from what it was originally. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this comes back to the whole thing of having to be humble within mastering. It's not my job to put stamp my sound onto something. You know, like I say, it's about getting it closer to where the artist wanted it to be originally. And sometimes you've applied all of this processing. And especially if you're overall boosting the loudness. Every time you disable your processing, it gets a little bit quieter and then you switch it back on, it gets a little bit louder and you think it sounds better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the risk, is that you think it sounds better because it's louder. When you loudness match it and do that bypass and hear it without that level boost, suddenly you realize, okay, well, I liked it a minute ago, but what it's doing is it making it sound kind of thin and hard in comparison to the original. I mean, often it's making it sound better. You know, often you've got it right and it's moving in the direction you want. But it's quite easy to get tempted to go too far with things. Looking for sort of excitement or buzz or whatever it is. And you just realize, that's not appropriate for this song or in comparison to the other tracks on the album. So, yeah, bypassing and especially loudness match bypassing is a really powerful technique.
Yeah, for sure. One question I had, was there a particular song that was more challenging to master than others?
I'll be honest, I can't remember, but looking at the,
was there a song curves, that used the most processing? Yeah.
Well, looking at the EQ curves, I'm going to guess that it was number 10, which makes sense. Okay. When you're saying that it had the orchestras, because it would be, especially does it also have the bass and drums? Is it just an orchestral backing, or does it have?
No, it's a full band plus orchestra.
That's what I thought. So if you're blending that, which sounds like the rest of the album, with these orchestral sounds that probably sound quite different because they've been recorded in a different space and all the rest of it, that's the kind of scenario where it can be quite difficult, because if they end up perfectly matched in the mix, then it's all good, which is what kind of seems to have happened with song 8, you know, where I ended up not using any EQ. You were saying there's loads and loads of instrumentation and parallel compression and things going on the kind of the overall result of that is it's come out with something that I thought sounded good as it was.
Right.
In terms of number 10, there are, that's got some of the biggest reductions. I might send you the screenshot of the EQ curve for that, so just so that people can see it, because it's quite pretty.
Yeah.
and they can see what I mean. And it's the kind of EQ curve that scares me, to be honest. I kind of look at it and think, is that going to work? That looks a bit a bit wild to me. I mean, I've got a cut at 120, a cut at 230, and 460. So 460 is kind of roughly twice, is exactly twice 230, so those are related.
Mm-hmm.
120, not so much. But I mean, you wouldn't necessarily expect those to be all related, those frequencies, because it depends what I put them in for.
Right.
I tell you what, let me just play this briefly to myself to remind myself. Yeah, so what I was adjusting for was mostly resonances in the drums, actually.
Mm.
Those were kind of very full and a little bit boomy sounding. In comparison to the kind of the much more open, kind of what you'd expect, you know, I mean, if it's a string orchestra in a large room, it's kind of much more open, airy quality to it. And I think in an ideal world, if I hadn't got a result that I was happy with and that you were happy with, I might have said maybe we should go back and either bring out some of that kind of the mid-range stuff in the strings to balance with the drums, or cut some of those things in the drums originally.
Right.
So that,
yeah, like have a mixed revision, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did get a result that I felt worked and that kind of blended in with the other things, and you didn't say, what did you do to the string sound in track 10? maybe now you will when you listen back to it, but it's too late, so that's fine.
It's very much too late.
But, yeah, I mean, that's a good example. So I do think that was a challenging one, and that tends to be the case, you know, in... Well, I don't know. I say that actually often just kind of solo voice, and it's the two extremes, you know, things that are very busy and where you've got lots of combinations of different elements can be tricky if they're not quite working together originally.
Right. Or like all in the same range.
Well, not necessarily even in all in the same range, but just kind of doing different stuff. You know, in this case, you've got this big kind of boomy drum sound and then this kind of quite smooth open string sound.
Right.
I mean, I think actually that's why I got away with it. If you had had a kind of thin, spiky string sound originally, right, combined with a big, boomy drum sound, that's the kind of situation where actually mastering is not going to work. Because if you cut more of those low mids out to sort the drums out, the strings are just going to sound horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. and, you know, another classic example would be like, well, the classic is bright guitars, dull vocal. So the vocal is the most important thing in the mix. You need to bring out some of that space and air and edge in the vocal to make it kind of cut through and to work. But when you do that, the guitar ends up screaming at you. You know, that's a kind of classic thing of going back and saying, actually, can we have a mix revision? So that's one kind of situation that's tricky. I mean, the other one is things that are very exposed. You know, where you just have, say, a vocal and a guitar or a vocal and piano or something, that can be really challenging to do as well, basically because what you have there originally is so delicate. You know, the reason I got away with what I did on that final song is that the arrangement is quite full and busy. You can be fairly radical with what you're doing and still have something left that works. Whereas I think if you used an EQ like that on just a kind of piano and vocal, one or other of them is going to suffer, you know?
Right.
So yeah, so I'm guessing that was one of the most challenging ones. I have a feeling maybe number one has a fairly complicated EQ curve as well. So that could have been another candidate. But nothing, you know, some projects you get, they're just a headache from beginning to end. And you know, that wasn't the case in this situation. None of it, I would say, was kind of had me pulling my hair out.
Right. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, exactly.
it's always, I think it's very common or almost universal to be second guessing your abilities at all times, or at least that's very common with me. It's like I think it sounds good, and I tell my readers that if you think it sounds good, it is good, but like there's always that nagging voice in your head going like, but is it really good?
And that's another reason why it's nice to have a mastering engineer, you know?
Right.
I mean, I spend a fair amount of my time kind of reassuring people and going, no, it sounds really good. Sounds great. You know, and right. You know, people will come in being terribly insecure about stuff that really does sound fantastic. Yep. And then oddly enough, you get people who are just completely confident and think it sounds wonderful. And you're like, actually... so yeah, I think there's a saying about that. There's something about you know, the fool always knows what he thinks, whereas the wise man is never sure. So I think if I would put self-doubt in terms of being wise.
That's good. That's
definitely
good.
And yeah, everybody has it. Even I have it, you know. It's there's a funny stage you get to about two-thirds of the way through an album. Probably, you know, kind of middle of the afternoon for me, which is not my peak time for kind of being alert and you know, on the case, where you, well, it's an interesting thing. Every so often you come across a song that just, you're working on something and suddenly you think the whole album has fallen to pieces. Right. You know, it's just like,
but oh my god,
exactly, none of my decisions are right. And the number of times I've kind of been gone through that and I'm going through agony, and then I suddenly stop and remember, oh yeah, I've been here before, that means that what I have for this song is wildly wrong. So because what I tend to do when I'm mastering is, once you get sort of a few tracks under your belt, you can flick between them quite rapidly. It's one of the nice things about having everything in a DAW. And so you can jump from the loud section of this to the loud section of this to the loud section of this, and kind of that instant juxtaposition of the different sounds, things that are not right tend to jump out at you. And the goal is that when you jump around, it all kind of sits quite nicely and feels part of a whole, you know? But yeah, if you have one song that's not quite right, suddenly it won't fit with this one, and it won't fit with that one, and it won't fit with that one, and it won't fit with that one, probably in different ways for each song. And that's what makes you feel like everything's falling to pieces. And that's when I start to question my abilities and my sanity. But thankfully, most of the time, once I remember and go, oh yeah, okay, I just need to go back to the drawing board with this song. And you bang your head against it for a while and you go, oh, it's that. I need to do whatever that was. And then suddenly everything comes together again and it's all good. But
taking breaks is also very important when it comes to that sort of stuff. It's just like, well, maybe I'll just come back to this in an hour. I'll go do something else to clear my head. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the nice things about, because I worked for a company here in the UK for about 15 years initially, and then left to set up on my own. And one of the nice things about kind of being my own boss is the flexibility to, you know, just kind of leave something overnight and come back to it in the morning and think about it again. Yeah, I would do it with record company stuff back in the day, but very often, especially if you had an attended session where the clients were coming to work with you, you basically had 4 or 6 hours and the job had to be done, because they might have come from the other end of the country.
Yeah.
Sometimes they came from a different country, you know, and so it had to be, and you know, they would then go away and have a listening copy and they might come back to you with a few kind of, oh, can we do this? Can we do that? But what's nice now is I can kind of, you know, work on it in the morning, come back in the evening, do some of the, you know, metadata and tracks IDs and all this kind of stuff, and just kind of listen to it quietly. And then, you know, sleep on it, come back first thing in the morning and just listen. And quite often then I'll go, okay, I'm just going to tweak that and that. You know, you get a fresh perspective. And that's a general tip, actually, for anybody interested in doing their own mastering. You know, one of the challenges, we've said it several times already, is where you're too close to it. You know, you've been slaving over this thing for months and you've just kind of completely lost all perspective. You don't know whether it sounds good or not anymore. And one possible solution for that is just to take a break, like days or maybe even better weeks. You know, if you're going to master your own stuff, and probably when you come back to listen to it somewhere else, and just make some notes, you know, listen in the car or listen on your hi-fi or on a, you know, a portable music player, somewhere where you listen to music quite a lot, so you know how stuff is supposed to sound. Make some notes, and then when you come back into the studio, you've got a fresh way of listening to it, and you might kind of make some discoveries that help you get a better result.
Right. Yeah, and well, speaking of people that are interested in mastering their own stuff, you have the Home Mastering Masterclass open this week.
Correct. Yes, absolutely.
And it closes on what, Friday? Friday the 21st?
Yeah, Friday the 21st of October for this run. Mm-hmm. So anybody listening now has a few days of it. Well, I mean, I keep it open for the first few weeks of the course. So there's no major rush, but there is an introductory offer on this week, which ends on Friday. So if people are interested in signing up for the course, they can save 30% by doing it now. and there is a... there's no risk to that. If you want to get the advantage of that discount and you're not 100% sure, you can, you know, try the course, and if you find it's not a good fit for you, I'm happily refund you. I don't want anybody, you know, I want people to get great value from it. And I'm not trying to trick anybody into doing anything. But so it's an 8-week course. There's a couple of bonus weeks, so it's slightly longer than that. And people, every week you get a new video from me where I master a different song in a different genre, usually in a different piece of software. I think I use most of the major software packages over the course of the course, using different plugins. And it kind of starts fairly simple with something that's basically sounds pretty good already. And just, you know, we talk about level and very gentle EQ changes. And by the time it gets to week 6, there's something where I kind of really go to town and it's all crazy stuff with mid-side EQ and, you know, a real kind of rescue attempt. Something that actually, you know, if it was actually presented to me as a master, I would probably kick it back for a remix. But that's not always possible, you know. It's, in fact, quite often it's not possible. Somebody comes to you and they need it tomorrow.
Right.
And the mix that you have is the mix you have to work with. So, it's great. I've had great feedback from it. Had more than 1,000 people take the course now over the years since I started running it. Something that's really nice about it is that anybody who's taking the course is able to email me with questions. And then 2 or 3 times during the course, I do, these days I do it live as a Google Hangout. So I do a Q&A session where I take the questions that people have said and answer those questions, and anybody who wants to can join me on the call and kind of ask me follow-up questions. And, you know, I have kind of have some friends drop in, and it's good fun because it, you know, keeps me in touch with whether I'm helping people with the stuff they need to be helped with. People really like it. And there's interviews with the people whose music that I'm using, where we talk about their experiences of mastering, what they wanted from it, pros and cons, all kinds of different stuff. It's
and also a big community for on the Facebook community. That's one of the things I really enjoy about it. Is just if you pop in and you want to ask a question or you get feedback on something that, you know, you have a question, not just a general question for your Q&A, but just like asking a question in the community, getting all these different answers and feedback on your masters and mixes is one of the more awesome things about the course. And I took it when it came out the first time, and that was years ago. There's so much extra value.
Yep, all of the content is available to you. I mean, you get to download it and keep it. I mean, I do it as a course, but that's really just to kind of give it some structure and to stop people being overwhelmed by the amount of stuff that comes out. I find it's more effective to give it to people week by week and give them, you know, say, okay, this week let's watch this video, then this. And I set little exercises as well as people go along to kind of help guide them through the process, hopefully. Retain access to everything. You're absolutely right. I've just looked and there are exactly 700 members of the Facebook group right now. And it's a really nice community. There's really, you know, there's everybody's on the same wavelength, you know. Everybody's glad to help each other. There's no kind of snarky comments and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's and people are very kind. You know, I don't think I've ever seen anybody kind of get told that, dude, that sucks, for anything, you know, for any examples or anything they upload or whatever. There's loads of stuff in there.
It's an incredibly valuable course. Just the videos alone are you just learn so much. It's sort of ironic to talk about it because I did take the course and I really enjoyed mastering, and then I'm talking to you about mastering my stuff because I didn't want to do it.
Not that uncommon. Because people, when I started doing this stuff, putting, you know, things on my website and doing products, you know, some of my colleagues were kind of like, you're crazy, you're shooting yourself in the foot. But what I find is quite a lot of people who do the course end up asking me to master their stuff anyway,
right?
Even though they might be mastering stuff for other people, And I think that's, you know, partly to do with the fact that it is hard to master your own material, to get that third party perspective.
Absolutely.
And then I get people who I master stuff for and they get interested and they take the course. There's people who take the course just to kind of find out more about mastering and what it can and can't achieve and what might be expected of a mix that they submit for mastering. There's people who've done the course who say that it helps them with their mixing. It's interesting. Kind of, you would imagine it might just be people who want to do home mastering and nothing else. But there's people who I've had professional mastering engineers take the course. I guess maybe they're just spying on me. and then I've had people who have gone on to master professionally after doing the course and say they help with it. So something for everybody.
That's great. Yeah. There's definitely something to be said about, you know, taking the course to know all of the materials and know how to do things, but not necessarily feeling the need to always do your own mastering yourself, but still wanting to know how to do it. Because like for this album, for instance, when I write 60% of the songs and then produce and record and mix it, and it's just, it becomes, you're so close to it that you end up definitely needing an extra perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on, Ian. It's been great talking to you. It was a very interesting conversation. I was very curious to hear sort of the inside scoop on how the Long Wait album got mastered and sounds so great. And I'm so excited about finally putting it out there.
Oh, that would be great. No, it's my pleasure. I'm really pleased that you like the album, and thanks for asking me on. It's good fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all for listening. If you are interested in joining the Home Mastering Masterclass, I am running a special this week that if you sign up through my affiliate link at audioissues.com/HMM, I will send you a free copy of my $49 product, Quick Mixing and Mastering, where I show you how to get a quality mix and master using only stock plugins. Check out Quick Mixing at quickmixing.com. And if you'd like a free copy with your Home Mastering Masterclass, just go to the link audioissues.com/HMM and sign up. Then just email me your receipt for Ian's class and I'll send you your free copy of Quick Mixing. Once again, I'm Björkvin from Audio Issues. Thank you and have a great day.